Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Troy Hall, so I'm your host on New Books of the American West, the channel on the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Ellen Baumler. She was the interpretive historian at the Montana Historical Society from 1992 until her retirement in 2018. She's the author or editor of numerous books, including Girl from the Gulches, The Story of Mary Ronan, and Dark Spaces, Montana's Historic Penitentiary at Deer Lodge. Baumler won Montana's Governor's Award for the Humanities and the Peter Yegan Jr. Award from the Montana Association of Museums for Excellence and Distinction in Fostering the Advancement of Montana's Museums. Today we're discussing her new book, The Life of the Afterlife in the Big Sky State, The History of Montana's Cemeteries, published by the University of Nebraska Press in 2021. The Life of the Afterlife in the Big Sky State is a groundbreaking history of death in Montana. It offers a unique, reflective, and sensitive perspective on the evolution of customs and burial grounds. Beginning with Montana's first known burial site, Ellen Baumler considers the archaeological records of many interments in rock ledges, under cairns, in trees, and on open-air scaffolds. Contact with Europeans at the trading posts and missions brought new burial practices. Later, crude boot hills and pioneer graveyards evolved into orderly cemeteries. Planned cemeteries became the hallmark of civilization and a measure of an educated community. Baumler explores this history, yet untold, about Montana. She traces the pathway from primitive beginnings to park-like, architecturally planned burial grounds where people could recreate, educate their children, and honor the dead. The Life of the Afterlife is not a comprehensive listing of the many hundreds of cemeteries across Montana. Rather, it discusses cultural identity, evidence through burial practices, changing methods of interments, and why those came about, and the evolution of cemeteries as the last great necessity in organized communities. Through examples and anecdotes, the book examines how we remember those who have passed on. Ellen, thanks for speaking with me today. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All right. So first things first, how did you come to write this book?
Well, it really was kind of a long process. As the interpretive historian at the Montana Historical Society, for 26 years, I wrote and researched interpretive plaques for the National Register of Historic Places. I probably did about 1,600 of those all across the state. And so I probably know more trivia than anybody does. But in the process of that, I also authored a number of National Register nominations, and probably half a dozen of them were on cemeteries. And so I researched the Salish burial ground at St. Mary's Mission in the Bitterroot. I researched the Jewish cemetery in Helena, the home of peace, the Pioneer Cemetery there too, which is Benton Avenue Cemetery. And then, sort of as the crowning of all of it, I researched the Conrad Cemetery in Kalispell. And those are all different types of cemeteries. So the research was all very different. And as, you know, I did that work, I realized that Montana really had a story to tell. And nobody had told it. And so I decided that as I was retiring, I decided that that would be my project. And so really years and years of research sort of all came together in this book.
Cool. Thank you for that. Yeah, I'm always fascinated by people, how people find their projects. You know, when it's a dissertation, yeah, you're either told to do it or whatever it is, but it's always interesting how bigger projects emerge from kind of stuff you've been working on previously.
Well, that's right. You know, and things do evolve from that. And, you know, I've done a lot of other types of articles and things, but pieces of all of those sort of came into play in this work.
Well, so to that point, right? So what did the research process look like for this book? You know, and as I was reading it, you know, I could tell there's a mix of archaeological records, public records, you know, whether they're death certificates or just tombstones, literal tombstones in a cemetery. So I'm curious about how you researched this and then specifically those sources you used to kind of pull this whole thing together.
Right. Well, I'm not an archaeologist or an anthropologist, but my husband is. And so I drew on him for the early parts of the book. And I felt like it was really important to include that early, the earliest burials that we know of, you know, I mean, of course, we wanted to talk about the first one. And so that was archaeological. And he steered me to different journals, professional journals and that kind of thing. And as I was reading that stuff, it occurred to me that it's not the kind of thing that the public would ever look at. And so the public really doesn't know this story. And so I sort of tried to synthesize some of that information and include that in the early chapters of the book. It was really a lot of fun to do that. And then as I went on with the other stuff that was a little bit more familiar to me to research, I really used everything in the historian's toolbox. You know, I used the Library of Congress Sanborn maps, which map early communities, and sometimes you can find the cemeteries actually platted on there. I used newspapers for obituaries and information about people that I was going to include. I went to a lot of cemeteries. I took a lot of pictures. And actually, you know, the hardest thing about writing a book, any book for me, is the pictures, because you have to have, you know, really good pictures. And that was really kind of the hardest part. But there was a lot of visiting of cemeteries, and the weather had to be right, you know, and all that kind of thing. So, you know, I used really everything in the historian's toolbox: census records, death certificates, all those kinds of things that I would use daily in my, you know, in my regular job, I used in this book.
Yeah. I like that. I think it was in the introduction, if I believe, about visiting cemeteries. And one thing that me and my fiance did, we were holed up in Conrad for 4 months, you know, just working. Well, I was working remotely. She works in a hospital, but we would walk down to the cemetery there in Conrad. And it was amazing how much you can pull from just a singular tombstone, right? So the design kind of gives away roughly when it was made. There's, of course, you have dates of birth, dates of death, causes of death, you know, and of course, you know, funerals are for the living, so how people want to remember this person. And it was cool to go to that far back part of the cemetery where there were still stone tombstones from like 50s. I'm making the date up, like 1856, right? And it was always fascinating just what you could pull from just a physical tombstone itself.
Yeah, you know, cemeteries are full of stories like that. And, you know, sometimes they give us impetus to look a little bit further into a person. But, you know, just walking around, you can really learn a lot.
Well, so let's just jump into it here. So as listeners are probably familiar with, we're going to work through the chapters. And so let's just kind of start from the beginning. We'll get to the end here eventually. But can you talk about what did some of the earliest burial customs look like in what became Montana?
Right. Well, the very first burial that we know about was the Anzac site. And, you know, that was really quite a find. In 1968, they were sort of moving some dirt in an area about a mile away from Wilsall in Park County. And the backhoe hit this cache that turned out to be the burial of a child. And for me, the interesting part, you know, you can read a lot of articles. It made the news when that happened. And even today, you know, you still read articles about the DNA that they extracted and all of that. But the interesting thing for me was looking at the fact that this child was covered in red ochre. His bones were saturated, and he was buried with a complete toolkit of stone weapons, meaning that everything was there from the very beginning of production, from a raw stone all the way to a tool that would be usable. And all the different stages of production were there, including weapons that actually had been used. And so it was very interesting to me that not only was the child covered in red ochre, all of the tools were also covered. And when they tested a couple of the finished tools, they found that they had in fact been used. And there was blood on a couple of them. Rabbit's blood was one thing, which is, you know, not too surprising. But the other thing, the other type of blood was camel blood. And camels were extinct, you know, are extinct in Montana. But at the time of the Anzac burial, camels were still roaming Montana. And this burial is about 11,000 years old, give or take. And so to me, those customs, the burial with the toolkit like that, really shows that there was a belief in the afterlife, because this child had everything he needed to learn about, you know, to survive. So looking at other burials then up through, you know, up through the history of Montana, kind of, there's not a lot of archaeology, but there is some. And a lot of the burials are people that are buried with, you know, things that meant something to them, implements like that. And as you go through time, it becomes really interesting because Native Americans still use that red color to wrap bodies in, whether it be a painted skin of some kind or a red blanket. You know, that's still a custom that really carries through from that very, very ancient time. And it was brought probably across the land bridge. You know, there may have been other ways that people came, but people probably did come from Siberia across that Bering Strait bridge, the Bering land bridge to Alaska, and then they migrated down. And, you know, this red idea is something that was brought with them, because you find that in Europe, you find that everywhere in those very, very, very ancient burials. So to me, that was a really cool thing.
I mean, one thing for that red ochre, right? And I can't remember if you explained it in the book or not, but so it's clear that that red color has been used for a very long time with burial, right. Mm-hmm. But what does it actually mean or represent?
I think it represents lifeblood, probably, you know, we kind of think of, you know, we use black, you know, as symbolizing death, but it's interesting that red, I think, symbolized death. And I think it's because it was the lifeblood of a person.
Okay. So let's move forward in time a little bit here. So what did burial practices look like as the U.S. extended its boundaries westward? And this is kind of think about when here comes the United States as they conflict, sometimes literally, with nations around here in Montana.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you know, trading posts sort of changed the way Native Americans buried their dead a little bit. Native Americans typically used open air burials. They would bury people in trees or on the ground covered with rocks, but not buried. Or on scaffolding. And, you know, one of the things that I sort of went out on a limb and collected a few burial photographs that had been published elsewhere, but they never had been published together. So to me, that's a really interesting thing to see actual scaffold burials, tree interments, and that kind of thing. At any rate, once Europeans came through and established trading posts or military posts, it was possible to get wooden-made boxes. Native Americans adopted that practice, and they would put the person with all their belongings bundled in a buffalo robe or some kind of skin, place that in a wooden coffin, and it would be the wooden coffin that would be placed in the tree or on a scaffolding, which I think is kind of interesting. And that's, you know, one of the big changes, I think, that occurred when Europeans, trading posts and military posts came along. All of the military posts, trading posts, had their own cemeteries. And Native Americans didn't bury their dead or inter their dead in cemeteries. They were single burials, except in special situations. And so the fact that these trading posts had cemeteries, you know, is kind of interesting. Most of those cemeteries are lost. We don't know where they were. The one that does remain is at Fort Kana, which was a very late trading post that operated into the 1870s. And so that cemetery is intact, which I think is pretty cool. And there are descendants of the McDonald family to take care of that cemetery, which is why it survived.
So going back to the burials in the trees, or as you call a cemetery in the trees, what was the rationale for burying up high above ground?
So open air burials, the idea was that it left the spirit free to travel. Burial in the earth doesn't do that. It encloses the person. And so Native Americans believed that it was very important to free the spirit, to let the spirit be free. And even today, you know, in very remote places, there are still those kinds of interments.
Okay, thank you for that. Now, so like you said, as trading posts get established, as the military sets up forts throughout Montana itself, mm-hmm. What do these burial practices look like on what we just kind of call the frontier? And kind of as a follow on question, right? What happened when some of the more informal practices started to intersected with actual urban development?
Yeah, well, you know, most early settlements in Montana and elsewhere in the West had haphazard cemeteries, and we call them boot hills because usually they were, not always, but usually they were on higher ground if there was a higher ground in the community. And these were places that were violent places. That was true of Montana and other places in the West, and people died very suddenly sometimes, not only of diphtheria or smallpox or whatever, but they also died violently. And so to die with your boots on, you know, that's why it's called Boot Hill, because a lot of people did die quickly with their boots on. So boot hills, you know, became, just sort of something that every community had, very early community had. And usually they were, as I say, they were usually on higher ground. But as the community then began to grow, if it did grow, urban development would encroach, and it would be necessary to stop burying people in that place and move out of town to a larger, you know, type of burial ground. And so those boot hills oftentimes just became forgotten. Cemeteries didn't usually have marked graves early on because it was very difficult to transport tombstones. Imagine how heavy a tombstone is and how much that would cost by ox team, you know. Plus, you had to mail order tombstones. There were no tombstone makers in Montana until the late 1870s. So you have these graves that are unmarked. Maybe they're marked by a forked stick or maybe by a stone, you know, three rocks in a triangle or something like that. But generally those things fade away or roll away, and the cemetery then just becomes unknown. And so sometimes in urban settings, you know, when people are road crews are digging roads or they're digging foundations for a house or something, you come across a burial like that. And people wonder why that is. Well, you know, that's because that's where the cemetery, the original cemetery was. It's true in Missoula, which is kind of interesting. Missoula had a very early cemetery from the mid-1860s that was in the lower Rattlesnake area. You come along going west on the interstate there and get off at the university exit on the right-hand side, that's where the lower Rattlesnake area is. And that was platted into urban for residential use in about 1885 or so. And the cemetery was discontinued about 1881 when the city cemetery opened. But a lot of those burials, again, you know, they were unmarked. And so the neighborhood was just platted right over the graves. And I know people who've told me that they have pieces of wooden coffins in their basements, in their basement walls, you know, and they have to be pretty careful how dig they deep their gardens and that kind of thing, because you do sometimes hit bones or burials or wooden pieces of coffins. In 1972, two burials were discovered when a guy was putting a porch on the back of his house. And those bones were taken to the coroner. You know, they decided they were historic. So the bones were given to the University of Montana for study. And generations of students studied those bones. And it wasn't until fairly recently that a student decided to use that as a project, use those bones as a project. And she determined that this person may have died of tuberculosis because the bones were very porous. She knew it was a woman. And so in checking, this is really important, you know, to check historic records, because in looking at the historic records, which nobody else had thought to do, she knew that the landowner was Cyrus McQuirk. And in looking at obituaries, she found the sister of Cyrus McQuirk, who died in 1872, visiting her brother, and she died of tuberculosis. So it's, you know, pretty clear that this was probably Henrietta McQuirk Harrison. So, you know, it takes a lot of work to use all of those tools, but sometimes it really pays off.
No, thanks for that. And I had a couple like follow up questions. And a lot of this is that, like, your section on Boot Hills, right, is so, you know, I have seen Boot Hills everywhere. I just never knew what they were called, right? Or maybe a little bit more, maybe not as old version of Boot Hills. And I'm always thinking when I'm driving down to Showdown, you know, from Great Falls down to White Sulphur Springs, and there are, I think, in Monarch and in Neihardt, cemeteries kind of going up the hill off the highway. And so for me, I'm wondering, what was the rationale for burying them uphill? I know why you don't bury them underground. You don't want to bury them underground in New Orleans, but it doesn't make sense to me why you bury them uphill, kind of overlooking, as it were, the town.
Well, I think, you know, first of all, like you say, overlooking, you know, for the panoramic view, you know, giving the dead something to look at. But I think practically because of drainage issues, if you bury, and not every, like I say, you know, not every community has an area that's above ground like that. But it was the common place to bury them just because the drainage was better, the view was better, everybody could see where the cemetery was, you know, and it was true of Bannock. Bannock's Boot Hill is way up on top of, almost on top of a mountain. And it only lasted until about 1880 because it was very hard to get a coffin up there by wagon, you know, and so I founded another cemetery that was easier to get to. But, you know, typically, if there is an area that is above ground like that, higher up, that's why they would choose that area.
Now, you know, there's always, I mean, how to put this, it always feels like that there is a, especially for this time period, both a logical reason, right? People are doing this for a reason, but it always seems like there's also like an environmental reason is the one that's undergirding a lot of the decision making, like drainage and things of that nature as well. Also wonder, makes me wonder too, is like, well, they look at that and go, well, we're not going to build up there with buildings. So that's land we can afford to use for,
you know, until later on when they decide, like in Helena, it was up on the ridge top. And it lasted about 10 years. There was quite a few people buried up there. And then city fathers decided when Helena became the capital in 1875, they decided they wanted to build the first graded school. It was broken down into rooms for the different grades. And they wanted to show it off. So they wanted to build it on the highest point so everybody would see it, right on top of the cemetery. And so we have a new central school. It's a third central school that has been in that location. And when they when they built this huge new school, I'm sure they discovered a few things that they don't want to talk about.
You know? Yeah, I can only imagine. So next, right? So Boot Hills, they slowly over time turn into kind of the cemeteries that we know today, right? Or that's where the development goes. So how and why did park-like cemeteries come to be in Montana?
So a good example is Butte, because Butte had a very early planned cemetery. And planned cemeteries mean, you know, that the cemetery is actually laid out in sections with driveways and that kind of thing, and landscaping. In Butte, urban cemeteries, people didn't stay buried because of the ground disturbance. And so they had to, actually of necessity, move the cemetery out of town. But it was a really bleak landscape with no trees, nothing would grow there. And so they platted out this cemetery with driveways and that, but they couldn't landscape because nothing would grow in Butte in the 19th century. And so they substituted art, really, artful tombstones, you know, and Butte became one of the most beautiful cemeteries because later it could be landscaped when things began to grow again. And there's beautiful art in that cemetery. So sometimes it was a necessity, and sometimes it was because there really was no place to recreate in urban places. They didn't really plan parks in western towns, and so there was really no place for people to go to picnic and that kind of thing. And cemeteries, grand cemeteries, beautiful cemeteries sprang up because it gave people a place where they could go and recreate with their families. I mean, that sounds weird, but that's one of the purposes of these park-like cemeteries, beautifully landscaped cemeteries. People could go there. They could take their children there. Children in the 19th century were familiar with death, you know. One in, I think, 3 in 5 children didn't get to be the age of 3. And so, you know, a lot of children died. A lot of children had family members who had died. And so mothers took their kids to the cemetery so they wouldn't be afraid of death. And, you know, it was a place where the dead could take their rest, but the public could take its leisure. And our grand cemeteries, most communities have a beautifully landscaped cemetery. And that's what they were used for, aside from burying people.
Now, as I was reading that part of your book, it reminded me, this was 2009, something like that, 7, I forget what it was. But, you know, I went to the Père Lachaise Cemetery in Paris. And the only reason I went there is because my friend demanded I take a picture of Jim Morrison's gravesite.
Oh, yeah, that's a great cemetery. Like,
yeah, isn't it? Yeah, you go see Oscar Wilde, and it's got, you know, lipstick kisses on it. And then, of course, you had Edith Piaf and all that kind of stuff. But it was the first time that I had set foot in a cemetery. And it's not that, like, I was necessarily averse to them, right? But the first time I set foot in a cemetery, and I was like, this is a beautiful place. I don't want to leave. You know, and so it was, well, for me, once I kind of had that epiphany, now I kind of look for these places to at least go check out and visit and stuff. And so is the one in Butte, is it still there?
Oh, it's a beautiful cemetery. Yeah, it's beautifully landscaped now and has just incredibly artful tombstones and sculptures and things like that. And, you know, one other reason that this kind of evolved in the United States is because urban areas became really, really crowded. And especially in New York, the urban cemeteries became so crowded that they just couldn't bury anyone there anymore. And when it rained, you know, there was bone gumbo, you know, the bones would float to the top. And people believed that lots of people died of, you know, epidemics and that kind of thing. And it became a fear of contagion. And so, you know, that's another reason why cemeteries moved out of town into bigger spaces and provided a place for people to go.
Could you also talk a bit about the Conrad Cemetery up in Kalispell? That's definitely on my to-do list, because the last time we were there, we went to the Conrad Mansion. And so now I saw this, I'm like, well, that's the next thing I'm doing next time I'm back up in the Flathead.
You have to go there because it is a really beautiful cemetery. And the story of the founding of it, you know, it's a really lovely story where Charles Conrad was a diabetic and he knew that he was nearing the end of his life. And he had never talked about his burial wishes to his wife. And so they took a last horseback ride to this area and took their horses out onto this promontory overlooking the Stillwater River. And Charles told his wife, Alicia, you know, this is where I want to be buried. And I want to establish a cemetery here that'll be for everyone, regardless of their status, community status, regardless of their ethnicity. I want it to be a place where everybody is welcome. And so when Charles died, then Alicia searched across the United States for an architect to design it. And she finally found this architect, and the cemetery was designed in 1903 by Arthur Hobart, who was from Minnesota. And he was a professional landscaper horticulturist. And this cemetery really is the prototype of Montana's park-like cemeteries because it has certain features. He designed it with these beautiful looping driveways that took into account the landscape. They didn't change the formations of the land at all. They followed the contours of the hillside, really. And they used the existing trees and shrubs and things and added landscaping to them, but they were very careful to add appropriate things. And so using the natural land and also providing these great sweeps of open space where there are flat tombstones, you can't even see them. When you look at the cemetery, there's a beautiful sweep of green grass. And it's full of flat markers, but you can't see them. And so it was really the first cemetery to utilize those thoughts of creating big sweeps, natural landscape, and it was the first cemetery that had perpetual care. And so that is really Montana's prototype for the park-like cemetery. But the best feature of that cemetery is that where that promontory is where the Conrad Mausoleum was built. And in the back of that, the hillside going down to the Stillwater River, Alicia had stone steps cut into the hillside. And those are called the fairy steps. And it's really worth visiting. And if you try to count them, you'll never get the same number twice. And it's true. And I think it's because you're so exhausted climbing up there, you lose count and you count differently going down. But it's really a wonderful, wonderful place to visit. I recommend everybody take a look at that cemetery.
You know, it's interesting. As you're explaining how the architect designed, you know, the Conrad Cemetery. Is that what it's called, the Conrad Cemetery?
The C.E. Conrad Memorial Cemetery.
Okay.
And they say it's the best last place. Your best last place.
That's going to be on someone's going to have to use some marketing on that one.
I know.
But right, like, so, and I think it's true of the time period, right, that's pretty keeping with, you know, landscape design and architecture, whether it's a park, as you normally think of, more cemetery themselves. But it's interesting, right, how they're using the landscape to create this beautiful place that they envision. So there in Kalispell, they have more to work with in Butte. But even the one in Butte, I'd love to see if I'm sure there's photos out there somewhere of you have a barren landscape. You can't plant the green stuff to make it pretty. So you bring in these beautiful ornate pieces of art as tombstones to kind of take the place of what you might think of it as the green and stuff like that. And so it's just interesting how folks do that
to create this final resting place. And, you know, the other thing about that Butte Cemetery is that the land is perfectly flat. There's no hillsides. You know, but there are the looping driveways, and now there is landscaping. Before, you know, there wasn't. It was just dirt, basically. And so, yeah, it is wonderful to see how it kind of evolved. And some cemeteries did evolve that way. The beautiful cemetery, Sunset Hills in Bozeman, started out just as a small pioneer type cemetery, and was added onto much later, like 1920 or so. And it was, you know, these beautiful looping driveways, and and landscaping was added later after the Conrad prototype, you know. And so it is beautiful. It's a beautiful cemetery today and has some beautiful cemetery art too.
So another thing too that you dedicate some time to here is just kind of the wide array of types of cemeteries throughout the state of Montana, and there's kind of two. You listed many, but I just kind of, if you could kind of speak to two of them. First off is actually either Chinese or Chinese sections of cemeteries. And I'm really thinking of Mark Johnson and his book coming out here in a few months that I'd like for folks to hear about. But then also the institutional cemeteries, so like Deer Lodge and stuff like that. If you can kind of talk about those types of cemeteries versus these big ornate ones that were that you just talked about.
Right. Well, Mount Moriah Cemetery in Butte that we were just talking about has a substantial Chinese section. And it's unusual because it includes the funerary burner that is characteristic of Chinese cemeteries, because they typically burn the person's possessions, which is part of the funeral ritual. I don't think that there's any other such structure left in Montana, although there was one in Helena. It doesn't exist anymore. But the cemetery is on the outskirts at the back of Mount Moriah, and it's probably in the ugliest part of the cemetery. And that's kind of typical of Chinese sections. In Helena, the Chinese section probably includes about 200 burials, but there are no tombstones except for maybe half a dozen. And it's outside the tended grounds of the cemetery proper, which is oftentimes the way ethnic cemeteries were done. Interestingly enough, in Deer Lodge, there is a row of Japanese tombstones that tell you that there was a Japanese community. Many, many Japanese came to Montana to work on the railroad after the Chinese Exclusion Act prohibited Chinese laborers from coming in. The Great Northern Railway and the Milwaukee Road and refurbishing the lines was done by Japanese. So there is that whole row of Japanese tombstones in Deer Lodge. There's a whole section in the Missoula City Cemetery of about 500 plots that are Japanese that were added later. They were reinterred there from other places, having died working on the railroad. Which is kind of interesting. We have Jewish sections, we have Jewish cemeteries, individual cemeteries. There are half a dozen of those scattered around Montana. And the institutional cemeteries, oftentimes larger cemeteries will have sections that are devoted to institutions, but poor farms usually had their own cemeteries. There was one of those in the Rattlesnake area in Missoula, again, you know, where that first cemetery was that we talked about, that early one. There was another cemetery that went with Poor Farm that's now the grounds of a school, and that's caused some problems too with people. The Deer Lodge prison also has, actually that was the very first institution to set aside a section or a separate cemetery, and that is in the Deer Lodge Cemetery, Hillcrest Cemetery proper. One end of it, the west end of it, is devoted just to inmates from Montana State Prison. And that was platted in 1870. It was the first institutional cemetery that was set aside. Warm Springs has a huge, huge cemetery that includes hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of burials, and it's all overgrown. It's really sad. The only markers are marking the section numbers, and those are all peeled, and the wood is kind of rotting out. It's a very, very sad place, really. And it's a shame that it has been neglected the way it has. There's a section in Twin Bridges for the Montana State Children's Home, and there's a marker. The graves are unmarked, but there is a marker there that lists the names of the children that are buried there. And the epitaph is "God's Orphans Now," which to me is really poignant. Yeah, so we have a lot of institutional cemeteries and sections in larger cemeteries for institutions.
All right. So we've been talking about, well, I guess in a sense, we've been talking about how the living bury the dead, right? Because the dead can't bury themselves. But actually, I love your last couple chapters. It really gets into kind of the not just burial practices, but the funeral and the ritual involved. And so kind of the question I'm asking is both how and why, or maybe why and how, do Montanans commemorate the dead? And because I live in Great Falls, I was if you could talk about Charlie Russell's funeral, and then the one that everyone has to know about is Shep up in Fort Benton.
Well, I think Montanans, we've had a lot of disasters here, and we do commemorate those disasters. Probably the most powerful and most poignant memorial is the Speculator Mine disaster, which reproduces the letters that were scrawled by people, by the miners before the oxygen ran out and they asphyxiated. There's a list of people who died building the Fort Peck Dam. There are crosses on the hillside at the Man Gulch, where the Man Gulch fire was in 1949. Crosses mark where each person fell. And we have this wonderful white marker program, too, you know, that commemorates people who have been lost in motor vehicle accidents. I think it's unusual and it's unique across the country. You'll see those white markers everywhere. And we like to memorialize animals, too. My favorite one, really my favorite one, is the tombstone for Old Pitt, who was a circus elephant that was hit by lightning in Dillon and is buried in the parking lot of the rodeo grounds. But also, you know, Auditor was a dog that lived by the Berkeley Pit for years and years and years, and there's a memorial to him. And of course, Shep is the most famous one. There's a wonderful bronze of Shep along the banks of the river up at Fort Benton. And there's a whole story about that too. You know, the Boy Scouts gave Shep a fantastic funeral and played taps and everything. And it was really quite a thing. And people, I think, do appreciate Shep, and they appreciate that beautiful statue that's there. Everyone who comes to Fort Benton learns about Shep. What else did you ask me about? You asked me about something else, too, other kinds of memorials. Oh, well, epitaphs is another way that we remember people who have died. And, you know, it's really more for the living than it is for the dead. And it is one way that we can walk around cemeteries and learn a little bit about different people. I think one of my favorite ones is the epitaph for Jack Taylor, who was an African-American guy, lived for a long, long time in Virginia City. And his epitaph says, "As long as the earth remaineth, seed time and harvest shall not cease," which really, you know, is the mark of a person who worked hard all of his life. And I really appreciate that that particular epitaph. There are beautiful little children's chair tombstones that are probably the most poignant of all the tombstones that we have in Montana. And there are examples in Butte and Helena and Bozeman and Deer Lodge. And it's a little child's chair with shoes tucked underneath and drapery or clothing draped over the back. You know, those little tombstones are just so precious and so poignant. The one in Benton Avenue Cemetery in Helena, the epitaph on it is "How we miss them." I mean, that just says volumes, you know, and it's really very, very sad. So, yeah, we have a lot of symbols and things that people use on tombstones. There are fraternal emblems. There are symbols like angels and doves and lambs and urns and all of those different things. And then fraternal emblems like in the interlocked rings of the Odd Fellows and the square and compass of the Masons and that kind of thing. And, you know, again, you know, it's really interesting to walk around and see what those are. And it just tells you a little bit about the person.
And that goes back to how much you can learn from a tombstone itself, right? Especially if you have one whose family really put their life on it, whether it's, you know, the empty chair, the fraternal order symbols and things like that. And so you know, they're fascinating things to read. If for any listeners, if you've never done it before, it's an interesting way to spend an afternoon.
It is. It really is. Oh, and C.M. Russell's funeral. You know, sometimes we did have these very elaborate funerals for different personalities. And C.M. Russell's was especially interesting, I think, because he asked to be in a horse-drawn hearse. And that hearse is has glass sides. And it is now actually, I believe it's on display somewhere, maybe at the Russell Museum in Great Falls. But as they were taking him to the cemetery, I think it's really interesting that school was called off for half a day so children could line the sidewalks, and you know, everyone came out to just to say goodbye to this person who had meant a lot to the community and to everyone, really. And as the horses are taking the hearse to the cemetery, there was a burst of rain, and there was a beautiful, beautiful rainbow. And, you know, it had all the colors of Charlie Russell's palette. And it was just, you know, such a fitting thing and such a beautiful thing. And I think a lot of times those things happen. And it's wonderful that we have those stories recorded, too, you know, because they do mean something, I think.
Well, we'll start to wrap this up. So just a couple questions left here. How can this book help readers better understand the American West?
Well, I think, you know, that people who visit do really like to go to cemeteries, and people like to walk around. And it is, you know, a local cemetery is a community in a microcosm. It is everything that the community was. And if you want to learn the history of a place, that's where you should go, because that's where you can learn about the disasters that might have happened. 10 people that died in the same year, there's got to be something that happened, whether it was an epidemic or fire or what. Rich, poor, institutionalized or ethnic, you know, all of these people, each person has a story. And each person's story is important. And every burial tells just a little bit about that person. And what they tell is, you know, is pretty much equal among everyone who's buried there. Everybody has a little piece of something there. And so I think it is a place that you can research people sometimes, but you don't even have to do the research. You can just sort of soak up the atmosphere and learn a little bit about the person and keep the person alive in the history of the place. And that's the best way to do it.
Well, thank you. All right. So last one. What's next for you? Are you working on anything else, or is this your opus?
It's not my swan song. I got a very busy summer ahead of me. I'm scheduled to do, I don't know, about 14 tours, community tours with big tour groups. I'm working on a book, 101 Places, with colleagues at the Montana Historical Society, taking my interpretive sign texts and expanding them. I'm always working on ghost stories. I'm collecting them. Anybody who knows a ghost story can tell me. I'd love to hear them. I probably almost have enough for another book of those. 5 of my books are very well-researched Montana ghost stories. You don't have to believe in ghosts, but, you know, sometimes you just can't explain things. And it's a fun thing for me to do. So all those things. Also working with the Library of Congress, collecting stories of Native American war veterans. And that's been interesting too. So I'm into a lot of different things.
I'm glad you brought up the ghost stories, because last October I went on a ghost tour here in town, and it was, I don't think I'd done one of those before. No, I did one in Memphis. But this was the first one I did here. And as always, I'm like, yeah, okay, right, yeah, that's what happened. But what I came to realize is that there were actually a lot of nuggets for really interesting historical stories.
History.
Kind of that's embedded it. Within the ghost story that I had trouble believing. You know what I mean? And so I'm sitting there, I pulled out a pen and paper and started writing down a list. All right, looking at this, looking at this, looking at this, looking at this. And it definitely, when I got done with it, I was like, okay, that was definitely worth my time. I very much appreciated the ghost story stuff.
The thing is, as a historian, it really gives me the opportunity to write about places that I would never get to write about. And when there's some little thread of something there, you know, you can sort of make it into something bigger just by researching the place and telling the story of the places. And that's really what it's about.
And it's not quite the same, but at work, I don't know if you've heard or not, but there is some UFO alien lore associated with the missile mission.
Yeah.
And so I've heard a number of those stories and kind of the same thing, right? I was like, all right, well, let's take that proposition seriously and let's see what I can come up with. And so that's kind of a project I've started working on, which may be more of a technological problem than it is green men in spacesuits coming down on flying saucers. But it'll be an interesting thing. And it just kind of what you said there kind of jogged my memory on that one. But okay. Well, Ellen, this was a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for your time. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.